Hello, welcome. Glad that you're here. I'm Nicola Ruffo. I'm the head of public programs at SwissNex. That's the Swiss innovation outpost in the Bay Area. And I have three interesting speakers with me, two of them Swiss, one from California as well. And I just introduced them shortly. Sarah Brin in the middle. She's a creative producer specializing in play, new media, and accessibility. She currently works as the digital storytelling program manager at MeowWolf. MeowWolf, yeah. Excuse my accent, yeah. And then we have here next to me, Tobias Weber. He is founder of already some film companies, and he started the technology startup Control Movie, which allows to screen choose your own adventure movies. And on the far right, we have Max Reiner. He is the founder of the VR company Somniacs and the director of the Interactive Experience Lab at the University of Arts in Zurich. So, first of all, applause, please. First of all, I was just wondering who is coming to our panel. Let me see, who is a filmmaker artist in the audience? Raise your hand. That's pretty good. And who is a technologist developer? Oh, it's about half-half. That's great. Because we are trying to now merge these two perspectives and look at possible futures for the cinema. And we have three different approaches. One is the virtual reality approach, which Max Reiner is representing in his work. Then we have Tobias Weber. It's a more interactive approach. And Sarah Brin will have kind of an approach on immersive spaces. So we then have each 10 minutes of a presentation and have afterwards 20 minutes to half an hour to discuss these three approaches. So Max, would you like to start?
Okay. All right, so I'm welcoming you here, and I talk a little bit about my work and my background so you know a little bit about my context. So I start the presentation with a flight of mind and or the creation of immersive experiences. So for me, I'm not from the movie making, I'm from the art world. Actually, I'm a media artist before, and I'm going to talk about how I create immersive experiences which might influence maybe the cinema later or not. And a little bit to myself, like I mentioned before, I'm from the Zurich University of the Arts. And I'm also the CTO and founder of Somniacs. Somniacs is a company which I started after a research project. The research project I started at art school, it was all about full body immersion and the exploration of the limits of virtual reality. Because most of you know virtual reality from the audio or the visual perspective, mostly. And I was interested, how can I enhance this immersive experience when I take the full body into account? And so for that, I started the research project Birdly in 2014, and it was all about flying. And so I thought it's a good exploration to check out a full body immersion when you start with a topic which is not only technical, it's just something out of the dreams, because people always dreamt about flying. And so I thought it's a good starting point to do an immersive experience to see if you really can take the body into this kind of illusion. And like you know, in the history of humankind, it's an old dream. So everyone wanted to fly, so even Icarus. And in the religion, we always see stuff which is going into the air, to be higher to God, to be higher to heavens. You need wings. And even inventors were totally captured by the idea here, for example, Leonardo da Vinci. But if we look in fiction, even in cinema, when you look into the into fiction movies, science fiction, or just superhero movies or something like this, you always have a scene where people are flying. And so I thought from there, it's a good place to start. And as I mentioned before, people, even inventors, were super captured by those ideas, and they wanted to create flying since the dawn of humankind. And a lot of them tried it. Some of them died. Some of them totally went bankrupt. And some of them just made themselves ridiculous. And so you see, actually, in the beginning of humankind, when they tried to start flying, they always wanted to mimic actually a bird, because this seems to be the most natural way how we fly. But as we now are in the year 2019, we know that our airplanes have wings, but they don't flap. And so flapping was not very an efficient way for us to get into the air, as you see here. But I wanted to build a flying machine which simulates actually the feeling of a bird. And so when I talk about simulations of flying machines, then we all think about flying simulators like helicopters or like airplanes. And this is not what I wanted to achieve, even if those technologies are quite established. Because the difference between my project was actually that you are embody a bird. So you don't simulate a machine which you can control. You don't have any joysticks. You should be just actually a flying being, so transformed into a bird. And I always have to say I'm quite lucky that I tried to mimic a bird and not an octopus, because this would be awful, I think. And so here you see the anatomy of a bird, so it was quite easy, more or less, to morph a human into a bird. And as we are from the art school, we started very low-key. You know, it was all about the experience. And so the main imperative was actually the experience prototyping. So we could start this at technical university, maybe make a CAD as computer-aided design files and waste time and money and so. This whole project here, what you see, is over a time span of 4 months. So we started from zero. We built actually a platform. We explored what works and so. And we used our most sophisticated rapid prototyping material, which we call wood, and just used a chainsaw, cut it and glued and so. And then we had the first prototypes. And this was actually after 5 months just of testing. And so luckily I have a lot of students in my university, which I use as guinea pigs in that sense. They tried the whole experience and gave me lots of feedback, which works. Just for example, a little fact. You see the fan? The fan is blowing. In this version, it was outside of the experience. But this really didn't work well at the end, because just think about when you dive down, you have the wind in your neck. When you fly up, you have it on your throat. So this really broke the illusion. So I was a little bit cheap in the beginning. I thought it's too expensive to put it on a machine. But I couldn't find another way to make it good. So I had to mount it on the machine. And here you saw the first prototypes after 6 months. And so we had the chance and the luck also to show this at SIGGRAPH, where we won a prize for the best real-time VR thing, but also we showed it in San Francisco and all over the world. And this worked pretty well, but then as a research project at the Art University, it was just too overwhelming. And then we decided actually to make a spin-off, to make a company, and to sell this crazy product, which gives people the ability to fly. And this is actually the version which we built it up, because the prototype was nice, it was working, but it was not actually a thing you should sell. And so this is the industrial version of it. And so this we started in late 2016, 17. And from there you might ask yourself, so what, where I can fly? And so we made the first tests and in nature, and people reacted pretty well. But we found out when we start to fly around in cities, the so-called human natural habitat of us, people get really much more involved in it. Because when we realized when people were flying 10, 20, 30 meters above a forest, They were not much tangled. They didn't felt that scared. But if we put them into the skyscraper area, and so everyone really felt the vertigo and the height, and they were afraid about falling. And so this was really quite an interesting insight which we got. And so we used actually for our first experience as New York, because that's a city everyone knows, and we used photogrammetry technology. So those cities are more or less scanned. And because in VR, everything is possible. And the first thing we did is simulating reality, which sounds really boring, but it was actually for us a good starting position, because it's the frame of reference. So if people really react to it, if they feel it, then it's a good way where we can go further. Because as we are from the art school, we really want to do the really crazy stuff, the more abstract things, but we needed to have a proof that the experience and the feeling of flying really works. And from there, we could go on because this worked more or less. And so here you see actually something from our newest production. We made actually an experience where you are 150 million years back in time, and it's more or less for science museums or natural history museums. So we simulate actually that you are a pterosaurus and you fly actually as this creature in an ancient time, and you can explore actually the area. So this is not much different actually from the experience from New York. Expect that you are 150 million years back in the time. And we built this experience with scientific advisors from several museums, paleontologists and so on, just to shape actually how the image looks like. Because you all know dinosaurs and all this kind of stuff in the movies. But the funny fact was actually when we started this, I always thought the scene doesn't look real. It has to be more jungly, it has to be more like grass and all this kind of sceneries. But then I really get taken down by the scientists because they told me, hey, dude, there is no grass around 150 million years. So the nature totally looked different. You cannot judge it from your knowledge now. And so with them together, we built this kind of past. And now we actually deliver it to museums, also in the field of edutainment. Here you see a little few pictures, so you can see behind the scenes. So this is the whole area from above, so, and this from the side. And we build in here also the vicious dinosaurs, of course. So, but you're lucky, you fly over them, so you don't have to treat or deal with them the whole time. You really can observe them, more or less. And here you see in shot the little... Usually, with our devices, you always are in first person. So to visualize this a little bit better, we also did this shot where you're actually in third person. This is still something which we like to explore because somehow it's weird when you have a body feedback of another object in front of you. That's a little bit strange because when you're in first person, then everything is one-to-one related. But in that sense, it's a little still a field to experiment. Yes, actually I'm already here at the end. I just wanted to give you a little intro in what kind of fields I'm working in. And in that sense, I would give it over to my colleagues.
Thank you very much. So next is Sarah. We just need to plug in the new computer and then we are ready to roll.
Yeah.
Ah, so.
Alrighty. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. It's so nice to see you here. Just out of curiosity, how many of y'all have visited Piano Wolf in Santa Fe? Great. Well, hopefully you'll come visit soon. And did any of you get to do our experience at South by last year? It's nice to see you again. Hi, I'm Sarah Brin. Thanks so much for having me. I'm the Digital Storytelling Program Manager at Meow Wolf. I am super excited to chat with you all about what we're up to. But before I do that, I'm just going to give y'all a little background about what we do and who we are. So it seems like if some of you aren't already familiar with Meow Wolf, we're an artist-driven immersive experience company. Our flagship project is called the House of Eternal Return, and it's a 20,000 square foot permanent immersive experience in Santa Fe, New Mexico. In addition to our Santa Fe location, we have very exciting new exhibitions opening in Las Vegas, Denver, Washington, D.C., and we just announced our new hotel in Phoenix. So that's just a little bit of background, but today I'd like to talk about digital storytelling. And while this term can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, at Meow Wolf, we think about digital storytelling as prototyping, testing, and implementing new technologies to add an additional layer of storytelling, agency, and magic to visitor experience. So with the time I have today, I'm going to talk a little bit about three of the components that we use to do that. And the first I'd like to speak about is immersive environments. Okay, what does that mean? And so if you were to visit the House of Eternal Return, you would immediately notice that we have an incredible team of artists and technicians who help us build beautiful, awe-inspiring, and painstakingly detailed environments. But if you look a little closer, you'll realize that this work is not just created by incredible visual artists, but by extremely skilled writers on our narrative team as well. Because of their incredible expertise, our exhibitions don't just tell stories, they build worlds. So, like I mentioned earlier, we have about 20,000 square feet to play with at our Santa Fe location, and we use pretty much every inch of that space for storytelling. And we tell those stories all kinds of different ways, through tangible physical objects you can pick up and examine, through the photographs hung on the walls, to the books and journals on the shelves, through the channels on the TV, through the files and programs on the computers. And of course, through incredibly thoughtful and sound and light design as well. And as we build these stories and environments, we design them to be dynamic so that they evolve and develop over time. The rabbit hole just gets deeper. What digital storytelling does is reach across all the different platforms and media, exhibition-wide, company-wide, and acts as a connective tissue, binding these multi-sensory sensations together, inviting and supporting visitors to learn even more, solve mysteries, and discover new worlds. By tangibly exploring these spaces, visitors choose their own adventures. The experiences are non-linear, which brings me to my second point. Digital storytelling at Meow Wolf is discoverable. Visitors can move through and return through the space in any order, building and mutating the understanding of the worlds they traverse. So that means that the visitor drives the storytelling experience. And they do this by choosing their own paths, by interacting with the art objects in different ways. They're opening safes, finding passwords, uncovering secrets, solving clues. All of these things are contributing to visitors' understandings of the story. So what we're building is basically layers and layers of art, interaction design, story, environments, a tremendous amount of technical infrastructure. And no single component exists in a vacuum. They all touch each other, they all overlap, they're all connected, which means that not only do we need a team with tremendous technical expertise, but then we also need these people to be extremely communicative and generous. And luckily we have that. This is our team and I love them a lot. And in addition to their very broad skill sets, the team is generous, interruptible, and flexible. Adaptation and responsiveness to findings, constraints, and new perspectives are integral to what we do. And this brings me to my third point. The diversity and adaptability of our staff helps us deliver an experience that I would describe as high amplitude. Okay, so I don't mean loud, although we do have an excellent sound team. High amplitude actually comes from the field of food science, so like the scientists and researchers who are building and engineering flavors in things like snacks and treats. And so high amplitude is a term professional tasters use, and yes, professional tasters are real, for a term when all the flavor ingredients blend together seamlessly to create one unified flavor. So for example, Coca-Cola is a really good example of this. There's real synthesis there. All the different ingredients, components become a whole. So, and conversely, if you have a store brand cola, you might be able to pick out those individual ingredients, those flavor notes of maybe like cinnamon or clove or whatever. And sometimes it can feel a little noisy. So what on earth does digital storytelling have anything to do with flavor? I think a lot of us are in the room, hopefully, because technology is exciting to us, or at least parts of it. And we want to make the world better and more interesting, and we want to dive in deeper to our dreams. But I think also we know, hopefully, that there's usually a huge gap between the expectations we have around certain technologies and what they can actually deliver. And at Meow Wolf, we insist on high amplitude experience design. We need the components of our worlds to blend seamlessly. We cannot let the shortcomings of any particular technology, no matter how hyped or reportedly disruptive it may be, we can't let that interrupt the worlds that we're building. Absolutely not. And not only does that mean we have to meticulously, repeatedly stress test and verify the technologies that we work with, but we have to let experiential value drive our design process. Even though we're a huge organization and it could be so easy to become overwhelmed by minutiae and microcontrollers and networking and budgets, we can't ever stop asking ourselves, how do we want our audiences to feel? Wondrous, incredulous, full of awe? And that's when we start thinking about how we might introduce technologies that might complement those experiential goals. Not a second before. So, I'm just about out of time, but to recap, for us at Meow Wolf, digital storytelling is about building worlds we can touch, feel, and explore. Worlds that are rooted in key experiential values like mystery, wonder, and joy. And as the gatekeepers to these worlds, it is our charge to remain skeptical of hype and methodically, rigorously examine the fidelity of our tools to ensure we're truly building the worlds we want for ourselves. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. Now the last one from Tobias.
Yeah, I feel like I can't contribute to anything. Because, I mean, we have those amazing artists that talk about, like, leaps forward. And I'm a filmmaker, first and foremost. I get trained traditionally at London Film School. So I think I'm like, way closer to cinema as it used to be, than these guys. But it's really interesting to see where you're heading. Nonetheless, I want to look in the future as well. I would consider myself a disruptor of the industry. So let's look ahead. What is the future of our communal experience of sitting together in a dark room going to be like? And probably this. At the moment, it's heading in this direction that we're just sitting at home, staying at home, not doing it communally anymore. It's great. You can don't have to leave the house. You don't have to buy tickets. You have your subscription. You can binge watch whatever you want. And there is no need for social interaction. It's fantastic. But is that really it? Is that where cinema is headed? I think, personally, it's a bit of a shame. I mean, I just love that, being together in a room and experiencing a movie together. But, I mean, if we look at the possible future of cinema, we probably have to look back where it's come from. So it's a very slow-moving industry. It's a very traditional industry. Much like this big ship that is just like on its path. And you know, we have seen development. I mean, there has been sound that has been added to the moving picture. They introduced color. They made it scope. They went into 3D. Did you bring your glasses? 4DX. So, you know, it became a bit gimmicky, maybe, eventually. I mean, 3D was great, but it's a gimmick. 4DX, definitely gimmicky. And now, what's ahead of that?
The iceberg.
It's streaming out there in the waters. So is this going to bring down cinema as we know it? I mean, the millennials may not even care too much. They may say, it's an event. Let's make the most out of it. But, you know, maybe they're not quite aware of what they're going to be missing. Maybe that ship was good, and it's good to keep that in some sort of shape and form. So what is that? Now, I mean, we heard Max talk about, like, the sort of art, like, the deep down inside ourselves. I mean, what the feelings. I mean, he went back to Leonardo da Vinci, the dreams of humankind. And, you know, I think the campfire represents that pretty well. I mean, sitting around a campfire and telling each other stories is a basically the root of where cinema is coming from, right? We're sitting in a darkened room, and it's like part of what we hear and see, but it's partly also what our imagination is doing to us. And most likely, it's also to do with the interaction between the storyteller and whoever is listening. And in a way, we wanted to reintroduce that feeling. So, as I said, you know, the improvements or development in cinema has been very incremental. And therefore, our approach is the same. And we call it MAYA. It's the most advanced yet acceptable. So it's small steps towards an improvement of the experience. So we're not like rushing into VR like these guys, and I'm not judging this, it's great. But this medium being such a traditional thing, we just felt only an incremental advancement is gonna be acceptable to most of to the industry itself, but also to the people. So what we did is we focused on the element of choice. I mean, we've all watched movies, and we probably disagreed with some of the actions. So what if we leave it up to the audience to make up their minds? Do we take the red pill or the blue pill? Do we leave or do we stay? Or, as in our movie, do we help her or do we help him? So we've introduced the element of choice into the movie theater by an app. It's really simple. Everyone uses their own smartphones. And every now and then, every 1-2 minutes, they make a choice on behalf of the protagonist. And then the story unfolds differently and reaches various endings. So this is the technology behind it. It's called Control Movie, and it has that app, as I said. I mean, it allows people to interact with the movie, but it gives them also feedback afterwards, so the discussion can continue. It allows people to engage with the film before and after. We have a media block that plays those things interactively in movie theaters. We have home entertainment devices, PlayStation, Xbox, whatever. It works in streaming. It works in mobile devices. We have, for filmmakers, developed our own writing app for branch narratives. We have our post-production tools that allow filmmakers to produce this kind of content. And of course, last but not least, data analytics, which allow people to see what choices have actually been made and improve their storytelling. So this is what it feels like.
The Maserati.
Fuck.
Give me the ball.
Papo! Where's the one here?
Excuse me, Bond Street?
As far as I can see, you're beginning to like playing this game.
Yeah, I definitely shouldn't, I?
Hey! You!
Smug boy looking for a fight?
Honestly, mate, I've got a bus to catch, all right?
You've got a bus to catch, have you? You!
Smug boy looking for a fight? Oh.
Let's find a solution out of this mess, then, shall we?
You can't not decide, okay? I am serious.
Woohoo! Oh, I did not expect this to go that smoothly.
You are your decisions, that's what shapes you.
So yeah, that's Control Movie. There are up to 10 movies now in development and pre-production, so it's coming to a theater near you soon. Yeah, of course.
So thank you, all of you. I think we have half an hour. I would say we would like to do it as interactive as possible. So if somebody has a question, please as well go to this mic, and then we can also include your questions into the discussion. I would just start first of all, maybe with something you started as well, like the cinema as a social experience, which you still think it's kind of very kind of key to kind of to still keep this experience together, to have kind of a social experience watching a movie. I would like to hear of the others as well, how they see it, what kind of importance it has.
I may say something real quick, because the interesting thing is when we started Control Movie and this experience, we designed it as a individual experience. Mm-hmm. Originally, we intended this thing to be on iPad or PlayStation stuff. And then we said, okay, why not give it a shot in movie theaters? Because originally we thought it's probably too frustrating for people to, you know, not get what they vote for. But it was overwhelming to see when we had our first screening with like 100 students at a film school, how they reacted, how they gasped and laughed and booed when they were unhappy with the choices. Mm-hmm. It was crazy, like the experience, the vibe in the movie theater. And then we realized, holy shit, this is way bigger than we ever thought. So in a way, it really brought this energy into the room and the quality of being together and watching something together and interacting with the story together, even if you don't get always what you want, but to see, like, this is my opinion, but obviously the majority now is thinking something else, is something very exciting. And
Yeah, we think a lot about that too. You know, people come to Meow Wolf and lots of places in groups or at least in twos, and so one of the design questions that we are thinking about is just like how do we lean into that? How do we accommodate that? And I think one of the really cool affordances of multilinear storytelling is that people are experiencing the same story through different channels, so they're getting different pieces. They're getting different pieces of information depending on, you know, the books they're opening, you know, how they flip through the channels on the TV in the house, etc. And part of the fun is at the end being like, oh, did you see that thing over there with the whatever? And then be like, no, I didn't, but I saw this. And like that opportunity to kind of like share and digest new experience with someone is really valuable and exciting and something we care a lot about.
I actually totally share the opinions of my colleagues, because even if you think in my experience it sounds a little bit lonely, you're flying by yourself, but still, if it's a worthy experience, you want to share it afterwards, and you want to share it with your friends and your colleagues to enrich actually what happens, to memorize it, and so the social component is quite interesting, whatever it is. Yeah.
So you have as well kind of a multiplayer mode?
Definitely. Okay. So we're working on that, because even if you're flying around or whatever, you want to be there in this kind of experience, not alone. Mm-hmm. It should be alive, it should be interactive, and what's better in interaction than another human being?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's also, multiplayer is always really good in a lot of these contexts, because people want to engage in different kind of layers and complexities and like degrees of intensity. So I'm like, you shouldn't have to be like 100% diehard fan, like reading all the lore in order to engage. And so it's cool to be able to have kind of a lighter touch. While someone in your party or someone who's with you might engage more deeply.
So we have already three questions.
I would like to continue right now at that point. And I wanted to ask Mr. Weber, you just showed a dashboard with data collected from the experience. I wanted to ask you, what kind of data are you collecting, and how are you using this data to create the blue value of the post experience?
Well, basically, we know whenever you press a button, what you choose. So the data is interesting for us to understand better which paths of the multi-branch narrative are actually used or viewed more, or in what circumstances people watch what more. So I think it's mostly going to be used to improve the experience and to enrich or more target the kind of storytelling for certain demographics and people. It's going to be used internally, and it's not going to be sold to Cambridge Analytica. Mm-hmm.
Do you? I know it's kind of a buzzword, but do you think of adding any AI elements to analyze this, or is this kind of? There are a lot of different startups now doing kind of AI. They use this kind of the big data that you gather to somehow analyze this?
I'm personally a bit critical about that because I still think cinema is an art form, first and foremost, and you can't really give that away to a computer. I know Netflix is using their data analytics, but mostly to give you stuff that you may like. I know there are a few AI companies out there who claim they can judge whether or not a script is going to make money. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, I mean, there are definitely indications, but I think sometimes it's the odd script that nobody ever thought this is going to be a hit, and then this is the one movie that makes money. I mean, it's such an unpredictable kind of zeitgeist-governed thing, so I wouldn't bet too much on that. You're personally.
For the unpredictable,
I'm too much of an artist, I guess.
Yeah, I see. So, next question, please.
Yes, as it relates to Control Movie, I was just curious the production timeline in comparison from Linear for how long. Also, how many outcomes you see, and then the age demographic. So, what ages do you see this working for? And then curious your thoughts on Bandersnatch.
Okay. First of all, like production wise, it adds, of course, to your shooting days because you're shooting more. It's not crazy, though. We usually say in terms of budget, it's probably 20% more to do it because you have a lot of synergies. You do produce, though, about, as a rule of thumb, probably three times as much footage. I mean, behind Late Shift, which is a 90-minute experience on average, there's 4 hours of finished film. So you want to give some depth to it so people can actually explore stuff. It runs into 7 different endings. I mean, I think 5 would have been sufficient, but it should really be, we always say it should be a little bit of a pyramid where it actually matters. I mean, because if you always come back to one place, and that's probably where I see the main problem with Bandersnatch, that it sort of forces you onto like that one thread. We believe that very strongly that this should not happen. It shouldn't have game over moments. It should always be a full film experience. It should be as close to the cinema that we love, but with that added touch. Yeah.
Maybe just a follow-up question for the others. I know we are all artists at heart, but how do you finance your experiences? How do you develop like even more immersive experiences? How does it work?
Yeah, the House of Eternal Return is kind of incredible for us because. People pay money to go there, and we're profit positive, which is really exciting for me, like as an art historian, kind of because it's like the artists are not dependent on a third party to kind of bring in the income, and so I think that's very exciting for me. And of course, you know, if you were here last year, you might have seen our partnership with Magic Leap, and so I think that, before joining. Meow Wolf, I worked for a software company called Autodesk, and we had an artist residency there. And so I think that there is a lot of nice potential for artists to collaborate with technology companies or third parties to kind of serve a very valuable R&D function. Artists kind of are innovators and creators, and they're going to push software, hardware, whatever it is, to its absolute boundaries. And I think, you know, artists are extremely valuable in that capacity.
Yeah,
Since I built a company, a startup company, of course we have to sell, and the field of location-based entertainment in that sense is growing. And so we can fulfill and sell our units there and build up also new kind of venues with them. Also museums, traditional ones, which are going more and more in the field of edutainment, and those, and yeah, even zoos and aquariums.
Mm-hmm. Great. Next question, please.
So this is a question for all of you, but Sarah mentioned that there are technological things that can disrupt the whole experience, and you need to meticulously and methodologically kind of mediate those things in order to achieve this more immersive and organic experience. Can you guys think of some cases where technology is interrupting the experience and how you mitigate it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, another part of my background is academic research in the sciences, and so that when I left that part of my life, I thought I would never kind of revisit those research methods ever again, and I was relieved. However, I was wrong, and so. User testing is just so valuable, and being able to kind of, you know, make something in paper first, or with, you know, as you were talking about, with wood or easy to use materials, and make a workable prototype before you spend a ridiculous amount of money, you know, hiring developers and technologists to build a finished product, and just to realize, oh wait, you need to make a bunch of changes, right? So paper prototyping is huge, and then once you have kind of a workable paper prototyping, bringing in people to test, and we start with doing tests internally. And luckily our company is large enough that we can bring in folks from other departments who are not as versed with what we're working with. And even without having to like take it outside of that, it's hugely, hugely helpful. But of course, like the next step is with intrepid members of the public, which is really exciting and scary.
Yeah, I actually also second that, because for us it's really important to have body storming, we call it like this, like brainstorming, but with your body, or the experience prototypes, because everything goes through there that you really can feel it, and you can really push the button a little bit too much and people get then overexcited, or it doesn't work, or they just feel uncomfortable, so you are walking on a thin path and you really have to fine-tune it, and there is no other way in that sense to really try it out and feel it.
Hi, this is for Control Movie. I'm actually quite curious about what you think the film criticism experience and process will be with the development of technology like this. Will it make it obsolete because the audience experience is more valued, and it's a very subjective experience with this kind of process? Or where do you think film critics in particular stand in the future with this type of technology?
No, I'm actually very proud to say that Control Movie is 100% Rotten Tomato proof. it's true. I mean, it kind of takes out that linear thing. I mean, and so everyone has their own experience a little bit. But it's a bit like reviewing a game, I guess, where, you know, it's not always going to be exactly the same, but still you get a feel of what that game is or what the message of the game is or the film. And, you know, the whole choice structure and the consequences to actions that are possible within the framework of the game are part, obviously, of the storytelling and of the message that you convey. So I think a film critic would probably have to watch it more than once or play with it a little bit in order to have a full picture and come to a conclusion. But other than that, I don't think it's much different.
Next one.
All your experiences are tied to a specific location, so location bound, and that's great. But Sarah, yours in particular seem very location based. For people from different parts of the world that are excited by Meow Wolf and are wondering how you might be able to bring those experiences, maybe in some small, discrete festival-type way to other parts of the world. Are Meow Wolf considering that? And have you got plans afoot for those kind of things?
I mean, like, our expansion plan, we've got a lot going on. And so I think that, you know, it's a lot of work thinking about how to grow the company in a way that kind of, you know, can can kind of match that enthusiasm. But also, I think just as important is this idea that we want to be a model. We want to be an inspiration. You know, Meow Wolf doesn't need to take over the world. We want to get other people excited about making things. And frankly, like, the more we can do that, the more successful we are. So I, you know, like, I think those kind of two hemispheres need to work together. But you know, I'm really excited about continuing to kind of share our methods and processes and creating a more just and sustainable arts infrastructure globally. Yeah.
Excuse me for my English. Two questions, little questions. Weber, the installation in the cinemas are sophisticated, expensive, or are simple? And Rainer, you are the installation for the system in the cinema spaces are sophisticated, are simple, are expensive, or not?
Are we talking about Control Movie?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it's an investment for the movie theaters, of course. But it's actually not as expensive as retrofitting a cinema to 3D or for...
How much? yes, for understanding if it's possible or not possible.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, the retrofit is around $25,000. $25,000.
Okay. And Rainer, thank you.
Excuse me?
Thank you.
Sure.
And Rainer...
Getting into business, here.
Yes, no... you are thinking another experience with another fantasy to the human experience. You understand me?
Yes. I am.
For Rainer.
Oh, okay.
You are thinking another experience with another fantasy, human fantasy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So our next experience is actually, you know, the whole machine or this experience is about movement. It's not only flying, it's also gliding. It's actually locomotion in that sense. And so the next experience we are doing is actually an underwater experience where you're a manta ray or a turtle and you can see how the coral reefs go down the drain. But luckily in VR you can reverse it and you see also how it looks when it's in a good state.
Also, maybe another interesting aspect is that we are talking now about the Western market, but at least Max and Tobias are also in discussions with China, the Chinese market, the Asian markets. Maybe also Meow Wolf once will do a kind of a expansion in China. So how do you see the differences in kind of... what is the expectation there of a nation or audience regarding your product?
I think in my case it's a little bit more simple because it's really an emotion and which we transport the fascination of being free, and it's just 2, 3, 4 minutes and so there is not that much cultural background which you would need maybe for storytelling, and so it works there as well because it counts on the awe and the fascination.
Site specificity is really important to me, and I think especially if you're working with technology which can feel kind of clandestine at times, that kind of feeling of place can be essential for adding kind of that feeling of meaning and of value. And so I think that that's kind of a really nice thing that we have in our expansion projects is that, you know, a lot of the Meow Wolf exhibitions are driven by kind of a core group of artists, but then we have artists that we collaborate with and bring in. And it's really important to those to us that those artists have roots in the cities that we're working in because... art should be a conversation and should be a dialogue. It shouldn't, you know, just be colonialism.
And for us, it's great. The Asian markets obviously are like super excited about anything new technologically. I think they're even more like glued to those kind of devices than, and so the adoption rate over there is crazy. It's an expanding market. I mean, they're still building a lot of movie theaters out there, way more than over here. So it's a no-brainer.
This question is for everyone. Just wondering, when you were able to try like the first working prototype of each one of your experiences, what was your personal reaction? Like, what did you tell your friends about it?
That's actually a really good question, because when I started to develop it, then I did it a little bit like, I don't know what comes out, if it really works out. And it took me several months till I had a working prototype. And the first time I was so impatient, I tested it when the system was not really done. I just tested parts of it, which was awful. It didn't work at all. It just made me so sick to the stomach. And then I really was prepared for everything. And on the next one, when everything works together, and it's really a fine line that the technology and the storytelling and the experience and everything really works with each other, then it was really an experience, which I was astounded by myself, that it works out that well, that you can actually trick the human perception that well in that sense. And I was more or less satisfied. But now, of course, after a few months and years, I'm not satisfied at all, and I would like to extend it massively.
Yeah, I couldn't tell my friends because I'm super mega NDA'd, so they have to wait, and so do I. But I will say that kind of moment of sharing, especially with testers, is really, really exciting, because especially if you're working something, it's very, very easy to get in the weeds and kind of lose perspective of the thing that you're working on, and having a fresh set of eyes to just be like, oh my God, this is amazing, is very energizing for me as a creative producer and for the teams that I work with. So yeah, you can't do enough of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's the same here. I mean, basically the feedback is so important to keep going, because we're all startups. We all struggle for money, and it's basically the positive feedback from like your friends, but also from like the first audiences is what keeps you going, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Next one.
Okay. Well, I have a question also too about Control Movie. I just wonder how it works in the cinema. I mean, what is happening with a large audience? Are going to put up a fight during the decisions, or what's going on?
Yeah, people do fight.
No, but how does it work? I mean, is everybody pressing a button and it's done then via majority?
Sorry, I didn't explain that properly then. Everyone has their own smartphones with them. They watch together on the big screen, and whenever an option is coming up, they see it on the big screen, but they have it reflected on their own phone as well. Everyone makes a pick, and then it's a majority that rules the house. Okay. And it's always like 2-3 seconds to make up your mind. It's super intuitive. It's super seamless. The movie never stops, continues across those breaks. And then it just continues, yeah. And then people boo when they're not happy, or they laugh, or they react in some way or another.
At least they're not texting.
So actually, it's a real. Actually, brings the audience really well together, because the audience is then in a whole.
And it's very interesting to see when the movie starts. Like, what is the mood in the room? And you always get a sense of what kind of audience is that. And then obviously that may shift. They may influence each other. But you do get a very much of a communal feeling for sure. Yeah.
I have one question also about Birdly. You're really finished now with the whole development of the experience. Mm-hmm. Will you stay on first person experiences, or will you also change in the next projects?
Yes, we also, when I showed the little video, it was a little test how we can actually experiment as well with third person, because it seems like in the age of GoPro and self-optimization, people like to see themselves mostly from the outside. So still, we have to do there some research, because it's a bit odd when you see something else as you feel, because we transform actually the movements and the feedback to the body. And if it's not the same what you see, it might be a little bit strange. So there we are still a little bit experimenting on that.
My question has to do with the length of experience. So I got a sort of a feeling that, 3 to 4 minutes experience, 90 minutes, more of a traditional movie. I don't know if it could go longer. I don't know anything about Meow Wolf, so I'm not sure how long your experience is. But I'm curious to know about your design process for figuring out what's the length of that experience, and then also figuring out what testing you did to determine whether something was too long or not long enough or that sort of thing.
Thank you. Good question.
Yeah, we design our experience so it's like you cannot absorb it all in one go. And the first time I visited just as a guest, I was there for an 8 hour a day. And that's because I'm a huge nerd. Like, I left and I came back for lunch and I was with a bunch of my friends who were like, and we're like, what did you see? But part of, we do this on purpose. So we upgrade the house, we change parts of the installations and we add more to the story. So the idea is that you should come back. And we do recommend that, you know, when people visit for the first time, they plan at least 2 hours, but really it's like, you know, it's up to you and what your brain and body can handle for sure.
Yeah, as you realized as well, we have a limited time because people also, yeah, it's quite exhilarating or exhausting in the beginning, you know, when you are in the air and you're the first time there to fly and you experience this the first time. So we have flight time usually from 3 minutes to five or something. We also had tests. People were flying for nearly an hour. But that's another case to create then an experience because, how shall I say, you also have to recreate the scene. And if you fly an hour, then you really need a big space to explore and keep the attention of the so-called flyer really on track. And so that's why we also boil it down. And like Sarah said, there is a lot to explore, so you can explore it by the next flight and the next flight and so on.
So maybe these last two questions, we are running out of time, yeah?
Hi, my question is around, have any of you done secret cinema? So the experience that, it's kind of struck me that between the three of your experiences, there could be some potential synergy where you all kind of work together. So one experience that I've been to, there's a very physical, immersive part to begin with, and then you actually do go to another part of it and watch a film. I'm kind of curious as to whether you see that between the three of you, if there's any synergy for you all to just get together and make a kind of super future cinema business.
Sure. Totally. Yep.
We'll all
the most interactive experience in the world.
Hello, I have a question for Mr. Weber for the control movie. I've experienced a late shift on the iPad a few years ago, and then I saw it at the Locarno Film Festival in the cinema. So it was really a great experience to be in a room in the theater with all the people, and they are shouting or say, hey, no, booing and everything. And after Bandersnatch, of course, I was thinking of, come on, when are the next film producers coming to use your technology with their movies. So are you having another new plans or?
Yeah, like you saw in my presentation, maybe if you were here, it's that big ship and it's moving, but it's moving very slowly.
Yeah.
And the studios are behemoths. They're super excited about it, but it takes time. So we have, as I said, like around 10 movies that are in various stages of pre-production or development. They will come out end of this year, the earliest in 2020, 2021. So, but there is a whole lineup of movies coming your way. So,
cool, thank you.
All right, so I just wrap it up maybe with one question about cinema again. So in 20 years, how do you think you will go to the cinema, or will you just immerse in a space somewhere? What is your idea, your vision for 20 years?
When you ask me like this, I think cinema will still stay here. Also, we have formats from the past, like opera or like concerts, like philharmonic concerts, classical one. And so I don't think that it will just go extinct. But the question is if it still keeps the market share as it has now, because this could be a little bit doubtful. And it's not the same like in the music business where you have maybe concerts and so with cinema. There it could be, the social aspect is important, like you mentioned, but if it's still strong enough to maintain these big facilities with hundreds of seats, I'm not that sure.
I mean, it'll be warmer. And in addition to that, I agree. I think it will be more social, more participatory. My hope is that it will be much more inclusive in terms of the channels by which we make and share these things are changing. And I hope we can see more diverse voices, different stories, and that we as audience members can be more participatory, exploratory, and curious as we kind of navigate and consume these things.
I play the role of the traditionalist here. I hope there will still be a place where there's a cinema where I can go in a dark room and watch a movie, maybe interactively with other people. I still think it's a crazy good way of telling stories. I mean, VR is fantastic, and I mean, I flew Birdly. I crashed in Birdly, and I thought I died. It's insane, the feeling of embodiment and how you forget that you're this guy and you think you're a bird. This is priceless. It's an experience. It's maybe a little bit less of a story.
Yeah.
And I think cinema is still an amazing tool to tell stories, to make you cry, to tell you something about compassion, about human values. And I hope that won't go away.
That's a good statement to the end. Thank you very much for being part of our interactive panel. Thanks to the speakers.